Health for You FM. You're listening to the Celebrity Series. I'm your host, Tanya McNabb. Our guest today is W. Brett Wilson, best known for his tenure on the hit TV show The Dragon's Den, where he used his own money to invest in over 30 entrepreneurs and their businesses with the hopes of taking them to a new level of success. Brett is one of Canada's most successful businessmen and respected philanthropists. His company, Energy Capital Corp, is a leading energy investment bank brokering financings and M&As in excess of, I believe, $150 billion. He holds a 12% stake in the Nashville Predators, not the Vancouver Canucks, NHL hockey team. His charm and small-town prairie boy charisma have helped him to win the hearts and inspire many, and his approach to philanthropy is amazing in that he's donated more than $10 million of his own money, which is fantastic, to nonprofit initiatives. At the end of the day, Brett is just another guy beating his own drum, and I think your most impressive title of all, Brett, is that you're a cancer survivor. Welcome to the show.
There's a lot to clarify in that intro.
Really?
I certainly appreciate it. I mean, I left First Energy 5 years ago, but I was one of the founders. And it's $250 billion, but that's okay. What's the difference between $150 and $250? But the only thing I really want to clarify is my perception of the last thing when you referred to me as a cancer survivor. I accept that term. I accept that a lot of people use it. But I happen to use the word that I'm a cancer graduate. And the reason for that is I think it's more empowering. I talk about the fact that I have my bachelor's in cancer graduation. I don't want my master's, but if I have to go back to school, I'm ready and willing. And I'll take it on again. But for me, it's just a matter of empowerment. Words have a lot of meaning. And I talk about this in a lot of things, whether it's charity or investments or relationships. But in this case, I think of myself as a cancer graduate.
That's actually a very good term. Now, for you, Brett, this all took place over 10 years ago that you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. I'm especially looking forward to talking to you because I have a bunch of men in my life and in my family that I'm extremely fond of. A few have had cancer, not prostate, but I know what it means to potentially lose someone or to lose someone to cancer. I think that there's some advice you can give us in helping us to protect the men that we love so dearly. So tell us a bit about your experience and how did you find out that you had prostate cancer?
Well, in my circumstance, you know, I had been tested at age sort of 37 or 8, and that was part of an industrial checkup on a life insurance policy, so my PSA was extraordinarily low. Then I had it done at age 40 at a time when, again, PSA was low, but it was just a general but very fulsome checkup that I had done when I went with some friends down on a golf trip to Phoenix, Arizona, but we went into Scottsdale into the Mayo Clinic. I was going to say the Mesa Clinic, but the Mayo Clinic. So we took that as kind of just a group team-building exercise, and five or six of us went down. Repeated that same exercise 3 years later, and it was at the Scripps Institute in San Diego with some friends, and they were just doing what they do in the context of a fulsome test. And we did the blood work on Friday. I get a call on Monday morning saying, really need you to go and get a biopsy done. Your PSA has literally exploded. It's gone from, you know, 0 point low to mid-sevens, and we don't like this. So I was rattled. Didn't mean I had cancer, but it meant I had to take a pretty hard look real quick. And so I did. I got in, had the biopsy work done, waited anxiously, hourly, daily, whatever, to get those results, and of course ended up with a call that said, the bad news is that you've got prostate cancer. The good news is that I've booked you for surgery to remove it. Well, I didn't like the idea of just booking for surgery to remove it, since I knew there was two or three or four different protocols. But that's how I found out that I had prostate cancer, and I was 43 years old.
Now, Brett, the prostate, just so maybe a lot of people don't know what it is, it's directly inside the anus, by the bladder, there is a gland, is that correct? And it produces nutrients and fluid to your sperm. So it's a necessary thing to have. I think that part of the problem as well, goes around... Go ahead.
The prostate actually wraps right around the shape of the size of a large grape or a walnut, and it's wrapped around the urethra. And so there's times when the prostate starts to enlarge due to things unrelated to cancer where you get some of the same side effects, whether it's dribbling or sometimes difficulty in urination. There's a variety of side effects that are notable. But in this case, the prostate itself serves as the, and my understanding, I'm sure there's a doctor listening who can clarify, but it's the primary producer of the fluid that's used in the ejaculate. So
correct.
It's an important part of the reproductive system. And if you lose it as a result of surgery or radiation, it doesn't mean you lose everything. You know, men can still have orgasms. They just are, I jokingly refer to it as doing so with the dry heaves, because there's very little, if any, fluid that comes out. And again, that's just part of the nature of one of the challenges that come with living after prostate cancer. And let me tell you that living after prostate cancer is a whole lot better than the alternate.
Sure. Now, Brett, on the, I think it's the U.S. Prostate Cancer Association website, they have a whole slew of information about how they don't agree with PSA testing. And it actually says, in 2012, the USA Preventive Task Force recommended against the use of PSA screening for healthy men of all ages, stating that the harms of screening outweigh the benefits. In contrast, physician-led groups such as the American Society of Clinical Oncology and the American Urological Association maintain that PSA testing is very important. Now, you have an initiative as far as having all men over 40 getting tested. What are your thoughts on the whole process?
There's absolutely no question in my mind. I'm an engineer by training. There is absolutely no question in my mind that knowledge doesn't kill you. So if you have a PSA test and the result is a high number, the risk is that you panic. Well, the challenge there is in making sure that the doctor who encouraged you to have the test is smart enough, is educated enough to manage your expectations. A high PSA is not determinative. It doesn't tell you that you have prostate cancer. It tells you you need to look. And so if knowledge is going to kill people, that's quite a surprise to me. And that's the way I look at this commentary. Now, part of it also happens to, I think, be a cost-related basis, where people say, why spend $20 or $30 on this PSA test when the results don't tell you that you have cancer or not? Again, knowledge doesn't kill you. Ignorance might. And quite frankly, they would have had to dig up my body to determine my PSA if I had followed their rule of thumb. Now, one of the challenges is they do accept that if there's family history, that you should go ahead and have your PSA test done. Well, nothing peeves me more than using that methodology of family history. You know, when I phoned my dad and said, Dad, I just got diagnosed with prostate cancer, he goes, oh, Jesus, first me, and he did have it, then your brother, then his brother, my uncle, and now you. And I went, what? Your brother had it? Uncle Ben had it? And he said, yeah, I guess I never told you. So family history is never complete. Now, let's also know that in the U.S. in particular, they say that family history means two data points. So not just your father, but it has to be his brother or your brother. Well, what happens if you're adopted and you don't have the data? What happens if your dad doesn't have a brother? What happens if you don't have a brother? That second data point can't exist. And yet it's required to determine that you need to have a PSA test done at an early age. Again, data can't kill you. It cannot kill you. I just can't find a way. And so I take deep exception with this narrow-minded perspective of the American Medical Association. And sometimes the Canadian Cancer Society has held out that you don't need to be tested until age 50. And I just call, forgive me, I'm trying not to swear on air, really frustrated by that bull twaddle that says, don't bother. Again, data can't kill you. You need to know how to manage the information and, of course, manage the expectations of the person that you're doing the work with and for. Now, there's a whole other genre of conversation about slow growth prostate cancer versus fast growth. And quite frankly, one of the holy grails right now in the world of prostate cancer would be finding a test to determine whether an individual with prostate cancer has what's slow growth, and could, quite frankly, you could do what's called watch and wait. You could live forever and not be killed by this cancer. Or do you have fast growth? And quite frankly, if that fast growth cancer breaches the capsule and goes out into your body, metastasizes, quite frankly, that is almost a death sentence. Not always, and for sure there's options. I mean, I had a high probability of that very issue myself, and I'm still here 13, 14 years later. So there's a long answer to your question.
Is that correct, Brent? So yours was contained? You had no signs or symptoms at all, did you?
I had no apparent symptoms other than some dribbling, and quite frankly, I didn't want to talk about it with anybody, so it wasn't even a symptom that was for review. You know, the last few drops, no matter how much you wiggle and dance, they still go in your pants or whatever that joke is, poem. So the real point of all that is to say I didn't have any visible signs of any discomfort. It was a marginal issue that I thought, you know, at worst it just comes with age, so I never even thought to bring it up. It wasn't until I had the PSA test done that someone said, hey buddy, you might have a problem, let's get a biopsy done.
And a PSA test is simply just a blood test.
It is simply just a blood test. Now, the gold standard in terms of testing, and there's some variations on, there's a rate-based, oh, and I wish I could think of the name, but there's another blood test that can be done that looks at the rate of growth of PSA.
It's the DRE screening, is that what you're thinking of?
No, that's the digital rectal exam.
Okay.
So there's the first is the digital exam where they actually go in and touch it and feel it and try and determine whether or not it's lumpy versus smooth. And a doctor with experience can tell whether or not there's been a change, if you will, in the nature of the prostate gland. And, you know, when I was tested, when I found out that I had a high PSA, I think we kept track, and I had something like 11 digital exams. And as I said to one of my business partners, you don't like it, but you sure get used to it.
I think that's the whole problem with men in general, is that just the whole idea of just having a digit placed in their anus is enough for them to say no. And again, you know, you have men in their mid-40s who haven't had that exam done, and some of the doctors aren't being proactive in actually checking. So,
well, the digital exam is a must, and the PSA exam, in my mind, is a must. And maybe it's every 2 years from the time you're 40. I don't care what your family history is. In my case, because I had it, because my dad had it, my son is super sensitive, and frankly, his plan is in his 30s, he'll start with a PSA test, because what you're looking for is the change in the PSA. The absolute number doesn't matter. I've had friends with PSAs of 2 or 3 who've had prostate cancer. It might have been slow growth. Doesn't matter. It was still cancer. It was the change. It had gone from 1 to 3. That told them something. There's sort of a standard in the industry that says when your PSA hits 4, you should take a closer look and maybe do a biopsy. I'm not sure it's as important, the absolute number is as important as the change in the number, and I think that's what most doctors who've done any work studying the benefits of the PSA test would say, that you're looking for the change. So the most important thing you can do is get a few data points, and again, maybe it's one at age 35, one at 40. If there's a delta, then check more often. If it's still stable and low, maybe it's every 2 years. I mean, use your own judgment, but as a minimum, ignorance is the only thing that will kill you. The data won't.
So what you're saying is, if anything, just start somewhere so you have a starting point to see that if in any given time when you decide to get the courage to get tested again, you'll see that it's the same or it's increased. And I guess PSA as well increases because something in your system is fighting the cancer.
The prostate-specific antigen is a result of the cancer that's in your body. And you did use the word, if you have the courage to have another test, I would think the intelligence is the right word, because it requires no courage to tick a little box while you're doing blood work.
Sure. And
that's all. I'm just making fun of the point.
Yes, and I actually was referring to the rectal exam, which, again, I think that
for
a lot of men is the big barrier to getting it done. Now, we try to lighten things up by doing Movember and we look at ways of making it sort of less serious for men to go in and get this testing done. But I had heard as well that you're involved in a project called the X Prize, and we're kind of running out of time. So can you tell me a bit about what that's about? Did you want to talk about that?
We're far from committed to it. But the concept of the X Prize was that the... Someone, Diamokinis, I met him actually in L.A. just last week, but he said, look, why don't we take a $10 million prize and see if that'll be enough to incent people to see if they can chase inner space and chase it in a way where we fly up into the stratosphere, come back down, and then reload and go again within a week. So it has to be a reusable rocket of some sort. And the interesting result was that over $400 million of investment was generated in pursuit of this $10 million prize. So if you want to extrapolate that idea to the world of healthcare, what we could do is create a prize or prizes or a pool of prizes that would say, all right, what are the holy grails of prostate cancer? One might be a better test. One might be a better test for differentiation between slow growth and fast growth cancer. Might be a different way of looking at the cancer that is there. Right now we use a score called the Gleason score, which is a little bit subjective, and we have two doctors read the same cancers and they see it differently. So can we get it to a point where it's purely a formula done by a machine? And the answer is probably yes. So we choose two or three or four things that would be each of the whom would be the elements of the Holy Grail of solving the dilemma or some of the dilemmas facing us around prostate cancer. We put up a prize and run that out on a global basis and say, all right, first to the door with a solution wins. But the reality is that we could generate maybe tens and tens of millions of dollars of research that's dedicated to an outcome, as opposed to research for the pure purpose of research, which I get, and lots of research scientists say, don't tell me what I'm researching, I'll tell you, and by the way, I want you to fund it. Well, I get that. That's fine. That's pure academic research. But in this case, I want to guide the outcomes. I want to guide the research in pursuit of certain outcomes. Now, the goal for the researcher is to win $1 million and have his test be the gold standard on a global basis. The result is hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars saved in terms of unnecessary treatment, and maybe tens and tens of thousands of men whose lives are better for it.
That sounds fantastic. Is that something that you would fund or have a group of people funding it with you?
We've started the dance, and so the challenge I've put out to a couple people in the community is, tell us more about what the Holy Grails are.
So
once we have that shortlisted, then we'll have a conversation about how we encourage people in the pursuit of that of the prostate prize.
Sounds fantastic. Brett, last but not least on my list is your ventures in Kelowna, Global Fitness and Racket Center. So you're obviously into being healthy. What do you do on a regular basis to stay healthy besides buying fitness centers?
Well, I've been involved with Global for a while. It's just I bought my partners out and then spent a bunch of money on it. So once we'd done that, realized that we'd stabilized, that we could actually start to grow that platform. So we've got a 3,000-member gym, and I would call it really a wellness center with the way we're approaching life. But the traditional name is Global Fitness and Racket. So what do? Well, my daily routine, and it's not perfect, and it's not every day, but the goal is to do about 15 minutes of exercise every morning. I don't try for an hour. It's 15 minutes. When I'm in town, I try and have a trainer at at the gym where I work out a couple of times a week. Unfortunately, my travels have had me literally out of town most of the last 2.5 months. Mm-hmm. And I leave for London tomorrow, so it's just a never-ending sequence right now. But so 15 minutes of great exercise. Predate that where I pre that with a glass of lemon juice for to deal with acidity in the body, and fresh squeezed lemon juice, and then I follow that with a vegetable-based smoothie with a bit of fruit in it to add flavor, but it's my 2 to 3 cups of vegetable-based smoothie, and I find it's an absolutely incredible way to start a day for vision and purpose in terms of just keeping your mind clear and hopefully your body healthy.
Fantastic. I'm a total advocate of smoothies. My kids don't realize that they drink and eat kale and broccoli on a daily basis, but they think it tastes like coconut, so what's the difference?
I'm with you. Kale would not pass my lips if it wasn't ground up into tiny pieces.
Exactly, and that's the best way to have it, quite frankly, so it's fantastic. Brett, thank you so much for your time today and sort of taking care of some of the mysteries that's around prostate cancer and showing that someone like you can continue having a fantastically healthy and wonderful life. I really appreciate your time.
And I welcome the opportunity, Tammy. Thank you.
I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.